He's without it.
Yeah, I'm with the H.
I'm no H.
Got the extra letter.
The correct way to spell him.
Well, I'm Jonathan.
Wait, exactly. Are you Jonathan too?
No, I'm J-O-H-N.
No, I know, but is
J-O-H-N is John. Yeah. J-O-N is Jonathan.
No, I've seen Jonathan with an H.
No.
No.
Yeah.
J-O-H-N is a complete standalone name.
Yes.
John is short for Jonathan.
That's not true for all Johns.
The only
I'm sure there's some out there that is not the case.
Some outliers.
Yeah, but that's
some rogues.
Sure,
the difference, if you will, of Jonathans. There are some Jonathans.
There's Jonathan. There's Jonathan.
Jonathans.
Yeah, A N is the correct.
But I also think there's a Jonathan.
No.
Johannes.
Yeah.
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 You are listening to Episode 5, Part 1 of the Screen Slate podcast. I'm your host, John Derringer, the editor and founder of Screen Slate. And returning as co-host this week are film archivist John Claxman, filmmaker and writer Caroline Gollum, and audio engineer C. Spencer Yeh. We're also thrilled to be joined by Dr. Ayanna Dozier, a scholar, artist, Screen Slate contributor, who originally we were planning to have on to discuss Batman, specifically queer Batman, kind of elaborating on a piece she wrote for Screen Slate. But there was a really significant event that occurred at MoMA. We wanted to talk about that. So this episode ended up becoming a two-parter. We didn't really want to like paywall one or the other part of the discussion. We hope you'll check them both out. We want to acknowledge and thank our sponsor, the German Film Office. You can visit them at germanfilmoffice.us, sign up for their newsletter, stay in touch, follow them on socials. They'll fill you in on all the cool German film stuff happening here in New York. And I also want to shout out one film in particular, which is Outside Noise by Ted Fent, which is opening Friday at Anthology Film Archives. Ted's a really phenomenal filmmaker. This is, I believe, his second feature. He's also made some really fantastic short films. And lastly, just want to shout out our Patreon supporters. They make this whole thing possible. We typically have bonus episodes for them, but because we're doing this as like an epic three-hour two-parter, we're not going to have one this week. But if you want to hear previous Patreon-only episodes, you can, again, visit patreon.com/screenslate. Thanks so much for tuning in.
All right.
We've done so many of these now.
Do you have any radio background? Did you ever do, like, college radio or...
No, I was a musical theater kid.
Oh, okay.
So I did do a lot of recording, and then I was the president of AV Club. And then really? We made short films in high school and
hell yeah.
Stuff like that. So like I only know audio because of film.
What kind of equipment did you have to maintain in AV Club?
So it was technically, I went to Ramona High School, which is a magnet school in the Inland Empire. And we had like the biggest theater for not just a high school, but in Southern California. And so we had to just do the lights and audio for that. And they finally got a little bit of extra money. And I remember Dustin Arduzer, who was head of stage, was like, I just want to get you guys some cameras. And he did. And then I started the AV Club. I was a president of it.
Whoa. And, so you were just a member. You were a founder.
Oh, yeah. I was a founder. I was the only, because I was one of like four... So I was, yes, the performer, but I really wanted to know the behind the scenes. So I was one of four girls who were then with the boys, as it were, which was really horrific for me. Mm-hmm. But it was fun because basically all of our short films were just us pranking each other. Like I remember I put saran wrap around one of their cars and then we threw like Jell-O inside the pool.
So you could always, and you could always say, well, this is for AV Club.
It was.
Like we can't get mad at us because this is for AV
Club. It's school credit.
This is our activity.
It was. Yeah. It really was. I was, you know what I was doing? I was keeping the kids off the streets.
Totally.
That's what that was. Yeah.
Well, I won't ask about the, unless you want to talk about it, the archive of the AV Club at your high school.
Oh man.
I hope those tapes are,
I still have my short film, the first film. So I was in school, I think a lot of my middle school and early high school experience was marked by Governor Schwarzenegger, right?
Yes.
Sure.
And all of his...
I've heard of him.
Yeah, his policies, which included taking sugar out of school. in California.
Okay.
So we were hit hard from that because a lot of clubs would sell candy to, you know, just get money.
Right.
And we can no longer do that. We had to sell, like, you know, Nutri-Grain bars.
Oh my God.
Which, like, what
would you like
fuck?
To buy some celery to fund the AV club?
Because, and that's because he cares. He cared about fitness.
It was like fitness. It was obesity. It was all of those narratives.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't working. So all of the clubs were hit because that's how all of the kids made money, like just small money to kind of fund things. So I started kind of underground candy exchange.
Oh, hell yeah.
And I would go to Smart and Final, which was like our version of Costco, and would just buy a bunch of candy. And then Dustin Arduzer's classroom, which is like, you know, AV and everything, he had this weird space in between that and the piano classroom where they had like a little walkway. And at the time I was doing piano, so piano was like second period, and then third period was audiovisual. And so I would be practicing the piano, and then like kids would tap wow. on the wall, and I had a lot of leeway because, you know, I was somewhat beloved in musical theater, so I would just like get up and go to the hallway and just like sell candy in that way. And then another club kind of caught on, so they started doing it as well. And I did the very classical drug ring thing that you do, is that I bought them out.
Wow, this is amazing.
It's like a speakeasy, what you're describing, like tinkling piano music, a false wall that you have to knock on a certain amount of times, bootlegging candy to get around the governor's fascist prohibition policy.
Well, I'm also curious in the governor's
right, the governor,
his term, what was the most popular candy to sell underground? What did people like?
Snickers. It was Snickers, because like, you know, you get a little sustenance off of that.
That's
like
right.
You get the jolt, and then you also feel like you've eaten something.
It's got protein.
Yeah.
The peanuts.
Yeah. We made so much money doing that. So we funded our short film, which was, I mean, not like super high budgeted, but I paid the actors, right? Mm-hmm. I rented a van. We like used someone's house. And then we had extra funding that I took the members to Universal Studios.
Oh my God.
Wow. Yeah. Did you do Backdraft?
We did. Yeah, we did Backdraft and we did Waterworld.
Waterworld.
And we got to see the tour literally, I think.
North Hollywood, right?
Studio City.
Yeah.
2 years later, I think the fire broke out. So we saw the original version of that studio tour.
You got to see the Psycho House and that studio tour is so good.
Yeah. Did the Psycho House burn down? Was that part of the destruction?
The entire thing did. They had rebuilt it.
Wow.
It's just not the same, though.
Yeah. I don't like talking about
it. Oh.
I know. It's a sensitive topic.
I get very triggered by fires.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Did they lose
Nothing happened to me. I just think
But there was that big fire at the Warner Brothers archives in Burbank, too.
It's really scares me, the idea of losing vaults and fires.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
and sets.
I don't even want to talk about it. I don't fuck around with fires.
It's horrifying.
Yeah.
When I was in school, I sold creepy crawlers and I got in big trouble. I got caught. And I always feel like that kind of deterred me from like a capitalist path because it was such a formative stage.
Somebody got like to you like early and kept
head,
you from
like,
going
make
down
money,
the wrong.
Make money. And I'm like, okay, so I made creepy crawlers and I sold the big ones for, I think, a quarter.
Creepy crawlers, like the
molded.
Like, the oven with that. Yeah. It was like with the light bulb.
It was like Easy Bake Oven for freaks.
Which heats with the light bulb, right?
Yeah. It was like the little, you know.
You poured into a mold.
In the 90s. Yeah, I remember that.
How old were you?
I don't know. I was probably 10 or so.
Valuable lesson.
Yeah. And it was like, then it was like, whoa, like, don't make that much money, or like, don't, you know, you have to like, you know, work in these like prescribed ways or whatever. So
I'm doing the math on this and it's like figure you get four big ones to a tray. That's a dollar. And how long does it take to bake a tray of creepy crawlers?
I probably made like,
it takes $8. A long time. It takes a long time.
How long does it take with that tiny light bulb?
Well, to heat the thing up, it takes fucking forever, is my memory.
It takes like 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, so then it maybe is not. I was thinking, you know, if you're churning out one tray every half hour, then you're making like $2 an hour.
Right. But speaking of making money, you are listening to
that was
episode 5 of the Screen Slate Podcast.
Coming in with the transitions.
Speaking about making German money.
Yeah. Brought to you by the German Film Office. So tonight we have our returning hosts, John Klaxman.
Happy to be here again.
Caroline Gollum.
Hello again.
Audio engineer C. Spencer Yeh.
Thumbs up from Spencer.
And we are thrilled to be joined by Dr. Ayana Dozier tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Of course,
like,
yeah.
The Cool Kids Club.
I don't know about that. kind of AV geeks.
I'll say thank you for thinking that.
Yeah.
It's if the AV Club were not already like a branded cultural criticism identity, then I would say this may be an AV Club-esque type crew, you know.
I thought my club was cool. So I used to tell ghost stories and scare people. So,
well, I think you've established that it was very cool.
Yeah.
And profitable too.
We made a lot of money.
And you made some cool movies, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So tonight we were planning to talk about Batman, specifically
Make Batman gay again.
Well, we were going to talk about Batman and
the Batman, which
and
just
the Batman.
Yeah, and expanding on a piece that Ayana wrote for Screen Slate. Before we get to that, though, we did want to talk about another thing that came up in the meantime, which is what happened at MoMA. We're recording this on Thursday,
St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah,
and Purim,
the 17th. Yeah. So over the weekend, MoMA patron who had his membership revoked showed up to the museum, was denied entry for a film at the film desk, and then stabbed two of the employees. And he managed to escape. It was a couple days before he was ultimately caught in Philadelphia. This is a very tragic and upsetting incident. It also hits close to home to us, not only as film goers and museum goers, but, you know, one of our dear friends works at the film desk. And in fact, Spencer and I were hanging out with him on his day off when this occurred. So, yeah, I thought maybe we could talk about it, how we can think about or process this event. We also want to be sensitive to the victims and the rest of the staff at MoMA. Ayana, you had put out a tweet addressing it that I think resonated with a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have two people who like the same things that I do. And then suddenly I think 25,000 people were like,
jeez,
very,
yeah.
Into what I mentioned. I think what I can recap is these are public facing positions. Anyone who takes tickets, anyone who works at a museum, and it's an operations staff. So it's the core central staff that are needed for the museum or a theater to open. And they're often the ones who are least protected. They don't have health insurance, right? There's no hazard pay, which I think is important to consider in dialogue with COVID-19 of like reopening. There is no hazard pay condition for them. And they're often the ones who also have to take on a variety of the various politics, I'm using that broadly, of the attendees, be that protesters, be that people who are grieved, be that people who want to get that free ticket or whatever. And the rule of thumb, and I speak as someone who worked front of staff for many years, not just as a ticket taker, not just at MoMA, but also at the Whitney, but then also had a very public facing role as an educator recently. And the rule of thumb or the central evergreen statement is that you just take it. You know, the customer is always right. Mm-hmm. And that leaves you very vulnerable to assault in a variety of ways, be that sexual assault, be that physical assault, be that even verbal assault. And none of those are ever considered as part of the job description. You know, if you complain, your manager is like, oh, I didn't know, you know, like, that's unusual, or it's a kind of shrug. So I say this in because I think what's been missing in a lot of the context around the assault is that these are spaces by which assault happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And I do think that in the jokes that are coming out of like, oh, it's at MoMA, you know, or even New York One, I'd mentioned this earlier, they were playing people saying like, oh, I was looking at a Picasso and how could that have happened here? And that kind of takes away from the fact that spaces where we don't perceive assault to happen is primarily the spaces by which assault happens. But it also leads us down not another, but a very tangentially related conversation about our public perception of why do we think some places are permissible for assault? Why do we think some positions are permissible for assault when the structure of the labor that goes behind it, facing the public, body work, right, is the same? You know, why is it okay if someone's assaulted at a Popeyes, for example, right, which happens all the time, than at MoMA? What does that say about who we think should be made more vulnerable and readily available for assault instead of tackling that as a question?
Mm-hmm. These institutions are imbued with so much reverence and import in the role that they play in a culture at large, too. And I think people will look at the fact that an assault happened at MoMA, and because it's imbued, or any museum really, because it's imbued with so much import, to your point, you don't anticipate that it could happen there, as if by dint of fact that it's important, it is absolved from the rules that govern every other facet of society. Wherever people are working alongside one another in person and together, there is the possibility of violence happening. And when you had brought this up earlier, you know, about how this hits us close to home as filmgoers, as people who know people who work at the museum, people who have worked at the museum, what it also is, what makes it also especially very shocking is that we all have personal experiences being somewhere where you think, oh, you know, I never could have anticipated that somebody would be so out of sorts. And then that realization of, what am I talking about? This happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And I texted you, John with an H, and you, John with an N, both of you.
Well, his name has
I have an N too.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, just
Jay Cox.
Okay. Anyway, both of you, as two of my dear movie-going friends and people I talk to often,
yeah,
you know, all last weekend I was talking to you guys about this because I was very shaken up and very mm-hmm. shocked by it. Shocked but not surprised was like the kind of general, general beat in talking to people. And in discussing this thing that had rippled throughout our peaceable movie-going colony, you know, that was the thing that came up the most, was that it's not... It's shocking, but not surprising.
Yeah.
That it seemed all of a sudden this collective realization of, oh, of course this could happen there, you know? Mm-hmm.
And what I was saying when we were talking pre-show was also that, you know, I do think of, in MoMA in particular, I'd say, but movie theaters in general as spaces where people go when they don't have other places to go. And I think, yeah, we were talking about how much it costs to be a member of MoMA, and $65, and you can pay $65 and you can go see movies every day for $65 for a year. So, you know, I do think of movie repertory cinema as being a place where people go when they don't have places to go. And I can't help but think about that in the case of the suspect in this case.
And even that $65 membership is still enough of a barrier to entry
for
that people
a lot.
People talk about MoMA and this sort of thing happening at MoMA in a way that, you know, they don't say about a library.
Right. Which, to that end, that was something that came up like on Twitter, is how many librarians reach out to me. And there's forgetting her name, but a woman who wrote a book about librarians being murdered by patrons.
Mm-hmm. And of course there was some sensationalism, which we were talking about before. And I think the cover of the New York Post, like, when I saw it, I was like, this is like Ouija crime photography returned. I
mean, it was like Ouija, but somehow tasteless.
Which is sensational. Well, Ouija's tasteless too. I mean, it's sensational.
I guess we have the privilege of distance when looking at Ouija in a way that we don't.
But it's sort of, to me, I was looking at it thinking like this woman in a stretcher, like, this is shocking and sensationalist.
This was... what was interesting to me about that was the way it seemed to like give permission for the kind of humor that we saw.
Yeah.
And, you know, so when this news broke, the New York Post shared images of the victims in stretchers. They appear to be like smiling or giving a thumbs up. And there's a quote, which isn't attributed to anyone in particular, but it says, "I'm going to get hazard pay," said a smiling woman covered in blood. And, you know, I think, again, it's like we think we understand to take the media critically, but a lot of people, you know, admittedly myself included, initially didn't really critically think about like, okay, this is the New York Post. And
that's,
and you know, it seemed to like, oh, look, the victims are smiling and they're joking about it. So you can smile and joke about it. And it created this really compelling narrative of like, tough New Yorker, you know. And
but I think the hazard pay thing, like,
I don't think that she will.
Yeah, I don't think she will. But I also think that detail to me was like, yeah, maybe in the context of the New York Post, it was kind of sensationalist and people took it as a lighthearted thing. But actually, to me, it was like, yeah, we were talking about this pre-show. This is a labor issue.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it's actually not, it's actually an interesting comment about that.
Right. You know?
So it's not funny. It's actually like, yeah, that's.
Yeah, you should get fucking hazard pay.
Yeah.
And so to that end, and like a bit like specific, right? Because, you know, you sign your contract when you get your job. People don't read it, you know, and especially the legality of it. And sometimes, especially when I worked at MoMA, right? And this is like when I first moved here 10 years ago, we didn't even have access to the legal language that actually would pertain to things like this. I say this in because, and this is something else I'm working on, but one thing that I did do at the Whitney was change the legal language for public-facing staff members. And that took 5 years. And so if that does happen at like the Whitney now, staff members are covered.
Right.
But most institutions, that's that statement that, you know, one could work in that job and think, oh my goodness, you know, I'm going to get hazard pay,
right.
But well, actually it's a union legally, job too.
Well, another thing I considered is that, you know, regardless of how one reacts in the aftermath of a traumatic event, the immediate aftermath may not be how one feels once the kind of reality of it settles in. And, you know, part of what, you know, made me feel really disturbed thinking about this was the idea of your employer on one hand putting like a friendly familial face, but on the other hand, then like going into a meeting with a lawyer and being like, how do we limit our liability on this?
Exactly.
And, you know, I'm sure there are other examples of sort of like a two-facedness of, you know, whether it's like reporters or, you know, random people online who think you seem cool and want to hang out with you or, you know, whatever. It's very, I think, you know, it's, I obviously don't envy their position and, you know, feel for them.
Yeah.
I would like to know that like the follow-up. You know, with the victims,
MoMA's
like
to, follow up.
Yeah, I want to know. I want to see what happens next month. Their hospital bill was carried or protected, if they didn't get sacked with that, I want to know if they keep their jobs. I want to know if they received hazard pay, but also we don't know the extent of their injuries. We know like that it was non life threatening. But, you know, maybe a disability comes out of this, right? Is that covered, you know? What about PTSD? What about therapy? You know, to what extent is MoMA actually going to do the right thing and take care of their employees? Or to what extent are they going to wash their hands of it after a certain period?
If they're going to claim, I mean, I'm not going to cast any aspersions because I go there as a patron and I spend a lot of time wandering in there. But it seems like the kind of thing where if they are smart... You know, you know what I mean? But you can also just as easily see any institution, we won't say this one specifically, but any institution looking at this situation and saying, we issued a warning, we revoked their membership, we absolve ourselves of responsibility.
I expect that to be the answer. And to that end, and this is cruel, but the smart thing for, and I'm putting that in air quotes, but the smart thing for MoMA to do is to fire them.
I meant my version of smart where they just do whatever the victims want them to do.
No, but that's what I'm saying though. Like you know,
I think you mean the humane thing.
The humane thing, to me, they are one and the same.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
If there's an ethics, the thing that would be the decent thing, but the, if we think tactically, that would be the smart thing on their part. And that has there's examples in which that happens because people who complain about their jobs or say this is unsafe, cause a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a scholar, Sarah Ahmed, she says, you know, it's only when you complain that the problem becomes visible. So the way the institution looks at it is like, well, it wasn't a problem until you started complaining. So let's just remove you and keep things as kind of...
Remove the person, remove the complaint.
Mm-hmm.
You can look the other way.
Yeah.
Completely. And curious still is that, you know, I went over there for a film maybe like late January, early February was probably the last time I was there. And they just reopened the film desk entrance.
Mm.
Because before...
Right, that's right.
Everybody went in through the main entrance.
Oh, that's right.
Which meant metal detector and temperature check and... all the, you know, and with the film desk entrance, it's like a lot more informal because I think they figure the lion's share of people that are going to the museum on any given day are tourists who are not there to see like a 4:30 screening of a movie, you know, real heads know the film desk entrance and that's the entrance that you go into. So they just, I mean, that facet of the museum and its function of being the place where people go had just once again been opened and identified as a separate thing.
Which also to me goes back to what I'm saying, that within the context of MoMA, the film, the theaters are kind of this other space,
right?
You know,
they're cordoned off and too. You like can go directly and to past us, the desk and to into us the
who,
theater.
To us who understand that, like, it's not surprising necessarily.
No, you don't necessarily want
people in the,
who,
in the media, they're saying, oh yeah, the people who go see the Picassos, they're shocked. And that's on the front page of the New York Post. It's saying stabbing at MoMA.
Right. And I had seen some kind of, you know, like very art worldy type people commenting about it. And something about their responses seemed ignorant to that idea. Yeah. Not only that it's a completely separate physical entrance. There's like something in between the main entrance of MoMA and the film desk, even like a hotel or something. Or and then
high rise condos.
The modern,
even in terms
of
the museum politically, because you know, like John Claxman and I have both, you know, done some kind of like consulting work for MoMA, or we know people there. The film department, I mean, really all the departments of the museum are kind of have like a wall between them.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, there's always been kind of discussion about how like media and performance is one thing and, you know, film curatorial is like a totally different department. And there's all kinds of, you know, history and politics around that. But I think it does speak to the way that, you know, this feels like an event related to MoMA's cinema, as opposed to, like you said,
the larger
like,
museum.
The people looking at the Picassos or the people, you know, whatever.
The better story for the New York Post is someone is stabbed in front of a Picasso at the Museum of Modern Art,
that's
which is
saying.
Sensational.
Yeah.
But the architectural delineation between the two spaces, I think, is very deliberate on their part, too, because they understand that the version of the museum that they want to show to the hundreds of thousands of tourists that go every year is where you see Starry Night and not where you are sitting among
in a basement
exactly
about to watch a 16 millimeter print of, you know, a William Wellman movie or whatever.
Yeah,
exactly.
Surrounded by people who are there because they need a third space that attends to a need.
Yeah,
exactly. And I think in the context of museums, that's a pretty unique thing that MoMA offers the cinemas.
Yeah.
Their
extensive film archive, though, is what led to that creation.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'm attentive to the differences, but I also am probably one of those people who's collapsing a little bit of it because I also then think that it matters that he was a member because like, you know, most films, I mean, you know, outside of MoviePass and then now AMC
like
Stubs.
$15 to see a movie at MoMA.
Exactly. You know, the membership conditions that type of, you know, repetition. And that's museum oriented that then can get the benefit of going to the films. Right.
Right.
And historically museum members are terrible. And there's a sense of ownership that they get out of that. And it's not, and I want to be quick about this, but it's not, it is absolutely related to the sense of property of like, I own something, you know, I'm part of this. And then think about how museums perpetuate that with like, so-and-so gave us money, so they have a little name here, right? Like museums are spaces by which you want to own something and you can't own the art. So that sense of ownership extends itself to the people who are there. And so the fact that he was a member and that sense of entitlement, I can come here whenever, that absolutely informed that sense of male aggression. I think the other dynamic of that then is that also, and the reason why I'm bringing the museum space back into it, is that yes, there's a front of house violence that happens all the time with the museum staff members. And I also want to draw in protesters in this, because I know people like to use that as a site, but think about who's the images of. It's the operations team. It's not the trustees they're attacking. I mean, it's, you know, they're the ones who are always suspected to such physical forms of,
and they're just trying to get to work.
Boundary crossing. Yeah. But to that end, then, to now take it into the metaphorical, there's also violence that happens like in that museum of all the times in which people like stab an artwork, you know, people do go to the museum with the intention to cause harm. Mm-hmm. Yes, that harm is often against operation staff, but like we have sensational events of someone slashing an artwork, sometimes as an act of protest, but that museums are historically located in violence, just like a lot of institutions are. And I think bringing it back to that level, instead of trying to think of like, oh, well, this is more violent than that, is not particularly kind of really attending to what's happening.
Yeah. Sure. I do think on the membership thing, though, like, yeah, I agree completely. There's a certain ownership, someone who has a membership and sort of that they bring to it. But I do think there's a certain group of people who also get the membership so that they can go see movies every day for a flat rate.
Right.
You know, and it's expensive, but it's relatively, if you go every day, because you need a place to go.
Some of these people who go, you know,
When we were talking about this last weekend and just, you know, and speaking also more broadly about that facet of film going culture in New York, that demographic, I should say, you know, one of the things that you and I were very quick to identify is how the movie theater acts as like a kind of a de facto, like daytime third
like
place,
a social service,
yeah. a rec center, any place where you can be outside of your home and communal and, you know, receive not to the same degree, but to some degree, the social services that you would receive somewhere else too. But what's interesting is the sense of entitlement that you talk about and the museum as being a site of violence is it gets back to this idea of the museum as like a hallowed place that somehow is not beholden to those rules. Because I think immediately too, if, you know, this guy's a regular, you expect the same service. Is it any different than someone who's a regular at a restaurant and feels entitled to a server's time?
Right.
Or is a regular on a flight?
Yeah.
And expects the air steward's time? You know, like there's this idea that the person comes with the property.
Yes.
The property is extended into their presence. And so they sort of come with the place like furniture.
Yeah.
And you can use and abuse them to whatever degree your perverted mind requires, you know. And the fact that it's now a thing that we recognize as being a part of our daily lives, which is to say just going to the movies, is such a huge shakeup for so many people. I think because the things that you mentioned had not really been previously considered or weighed in that same way, you know, and think of it to your point, you know, people are assaulted on the job all the time in any number of places where people serve other people.
Yeah.
It comes with the territory. It shouldn't, but it does. And we are never shocked by it.
I just wanted to say also that, you know, film desk staff, like, you know, we're definitely a lot more connected to them versus like museum guards. Like, consider and think about at least like, you know, like I just don't hear about, you know, like the experience of, you know, the guards like on a regular basis, but like they're the ones that are supposed to be like the barrier. Yeah. As a prompt.
So there is something to that. And,
wait, do you mean, although, sorry to interrupt, but do you mean like the security guards or like
the gallery attendants.
Yeah.
So, this gets really deep down the rabbit hole in labor, but this is like, you know, 10 years of working at a museum. So you don't, and this is not me speaking, this is, you know, strategy. You don't want staff to unionize. You don't want staff to build solidarity and connections with one another. You don't want them to work across departments and disciplines. You want them isolated, alienated from one another, right? And that's capitalism. That's how you keep the machine going. And so one of the ways in which that tactic is deployed is to, and this has happened over the last 10 to 15 years, the, you know, museum guard position was like, you know, if you think of artworks like Fred Wilson, right? You know, that's a historic position. There are still people, you know, who have been at a museum for 30, 40, 50 years, right? Like that's a legacy position. 15 years ago-ish, roughly, that's when we started to see the trend of outsourcing that, right? So you work with a third party company and you just bring in new guards all the time, right? And they're not unionized. They don't, you know, they don't know the staff. They're not a part of the quote unquote museum's identity. And that's a clear break that we've seen. But then you also do this other thing that's happened with the creation of gallery attendants, because before that used to be the museum guard position, right? And again, that would be the position of someone who's been there for 20 years and like, oh, I love looking at this work. It's a fun conversation. But now you get a gallery attendant. You specifically prioritize that position of being a young individual, 20, 26, you know?
Someone that's chic. Right.
That's more often than not you see them at PS1.
Exactly. And but you, what you do, though, is you make a limited number of those positions full-time, right? Like maybe one or two. So that way you hook everyone else working into part-time. So you give this illusion that if you work your way through it, you stay in it, you can become full-time. So I say that then because you have these new divisions that used to not really exist in the construction of the identity of the museum, of what it meant to be a part of that, but also what it meant to take care of one another within those spaces, where there's not only fractured, but it's also a kind of high turnover in the gallery attendance, right? Because really only two people can stay and you want to keep it going, and then a high turnover in the guards position because it's completely outsourced labor that allows you to underpay them and create these fissures that no longer that used to not really exist. There's a handful of guards at some institutions who are still there, the old crew, as it were, and you know
they're like grandfathered in though.
They're grandfathered in, and essentially what a lot of museums are waiting for, and it's wretched, you know, but they're waiting for them to pass on and to kind of adapt these new models. So that, and I think, you know, that was another conversation people asked, you know, why didn't the guard step in? And my first thought was like, well, was he a temp? Right? Because if he's a temp, he may be making $15 an hour, you know? Mm-hmm. And he also is probably, this is like, it could have been his first day, could have been like his second day. And he's kind of
also probably was not trained to de-escalate a situation like that.
I mean, that's exactly what I thought when I read the details. Like, what is the security guard paid at MoMA at the film desk even?
I mean, if it's a contractor, probably as little as they possibly can pay anybody, you know?
There was an artwork going around by the artist. I'm going to try to pull it up, but they interviewed guards at the Met and they, the piece is just the buttons and it's how long you've worked here and what, how much you make. And it's so depressing.
I saw that.
Like, it's 24 years, 34 years. And they're still at like 1875, 2275.
Yeah.
And it's
very interesting piece.
And you just see that a lot of them feel, you know, kind of like that's the only thing they've had. And again, then it's in an age thing, but then this gets us into like, you know, the need for a guard in a position like that of like, do you need to be, you know, a kind of viral to a degree of like, will you fight back? But that's, I think that's separate. I think it's just commentary of, you know, I never had a question about the guard. Like, that's not something that came into my mind of like, oh, why didn't he do anything? I think my tension is on the attacker.
Well, and also the museum, in as much as they have a public identity that's manifested in the bodies of their staff, the guards, I think, are probably even more meant to be somewhat anonymous or non-distinct too, right? You wear a uniform in any position that you work in an institution, you know, you have to wear a uniform. But the guards are like, to your point, changeable. They're people who may not work the same hours week over week. You know, we don't know what that scheduling is like. They may not know their colleagues. Their colleagues may not know them because it's such a high turnover. It could be any number of things. And it's also, you know, what is the work that everyone is expected to do?
Yeah.
You want cheerful women greeting customers and you want men keeping an eye on the property.
Well, it's also a highly racialized position. Well, all of operations in the museum is racialized. And that's one thing that has always irked me is when you get the conversation of diversify the museum. And I'm like, technically the museum is already quite diverse. If you actually just did a straight poll, you'll get a very diverse set of numbers across ethnicities and gender. It's where that diversity falls, right? And it's operations. And in this way, and I don't mean to be conceptual about it, but it to me, it's material and it's absolutely applicable. Like front of house, that's plantation language, right? Mm-hmm. It is. Who's front of house staff, right? Who's serving direct access to the owner in that way. And a lot of that type of mentality kind of embedded in enslavement, which I think informs a lot of people's desire to be property owners and a legacy around inheritance in this country, is also manifests itself in these weird corporeal ways mm-hmm. at the museum, where you get your guards, your smiling guards, highly racialized, right? Your smiling women, most of the time often racialized as well, not always. And you treat them as you would because they're your property. And then you go up to the higher ups, right? And then architecturally, this is reinforced in the museum where the most important people meet on the top floor and they have to oversee. And even that language is actually embedded in some of the back of house speak, the overseers of the institution. So it's...
And it's about who the institution deems presentable enough as well, too.
Yeah.
Who do you want in the front of the house representing your household by extension?
Yeah.
I was thinking of our friends, the archivists who worked in the basement in like a broom closet.
But, well, actually, it's interesting. They literally...
Speaking of what the museum prioritizes.
Yeah, well, they literally worked in a... what used to be
the catering...
No, search. Even better. The former wine cellar of MoMA.
Wow.
Oh.
Mm.
That has since changed, but...
Yeah. MoMA doesn't have a wine cellar anymore,
They moved it, I guess. I don't know.
There is something about a very venerable...
It's very 1950s.
It's super 1950s, like, for big donors and artists to FET people, but it also does speak to this, like, plantation-esque house kind of thing, having cellar in a museum. Honestly,
it's a detail I couldn't forget.
I mean, of course.
It was really illuminating to me, though, you know, when we would go to visit them, because, you know, this is through my previous day job doing media preservation. When you would go to the wine cellar to visit them, you would see the sort of like underground corridors of the museum where like the catering and events people are and all the things that you don't think of. And like there are little like colored lines to kind of like help guide you around the sort of like
the labyrinth under the
servants
labyrinth.
entrances and back passages,
totally.
Of course.
Yeah.
I went to when I just brief tangent that actually has, you know, something applicable to this conversation is I was in Florida last week and I went to the Vizcaya Gardens in Miami, and the way that the house is laid out, you know, it's like a big courtyard, a bunch of kind of dormitory style, fancy early 1900s rooms. And then on the ground floor and just outside of that are all these different pass-throughs, and you know, they have all these multiple rooms that were like, is this a kitchen? ? You read on the placard. Is this a kitchen? No, it's not. It's one of the many places where servants would have to relay things constantly for the people staying there. And you go into a room that's the size of like a New York apartment and it's not even the kitchen.
Yeah.
It's just a landing area for administrative serving work, you know. Yeah. And museums are just like that. They have to cater to that same kind of clientele, which is another strange kind of duality that makes this incident so fascinating, is the fact that MoMA is an elite institution that is modeled on, in many ways, a lot of different carceral systems or class-based systems.
It's actually funded with... private prison.
That too. Yeah. So quite literally. But it has also got this weird, even though you got to pay to play, this strange accessibility, or I should say like ease of use for people who are not in that rarefied milieu.
Mm-hmm. But
they can feel like they are.
Yeah, this... I'm quite mercurial in general, but also in my brain. So it's like, this also reminds me of Foucault and the birth of the clinic, of how institutions like the museum were actually created to take drunk people off the street. Mm-hmm. Like that's the whole point of it, was like a way to sanitize the environment was that you have the birth of the prison as a carceral system to kind of also be utilized as real estate and labor. And then what do you do with those who don't fall into that category, right? Where you don't, whatever systemic structure you've implemented, you put them in.
You mean people who can evade the prison by some means?
Various means, largely race. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Interesting.
Okay. So we're going to listen to a message that Steve McFarlane sent us.
I've never met the man, so
at Dimension
it's
Tide.
A name that just comes the around. Legend.
At Dimension Tide, do you know?
And we've known Steve for a long time through Spectacle Theater. Like he and I and some other people were early programmers there, and Caroline, you were in Cinebeasts.
And Live Journal.
Live Journal. Oh, ooh. yeah, we've talked about. But so this is something Steve sent.
Hey, John. I just want to say, seeing a lot of jokes about the victims that are in very poor taste, and I've seen also jokes about the perp, Gary Cabana, which are in less poor taste, but I wish people could remember most of the repertory cinemas in New York City are de facto loony bins for itinerant lost souls who have no family or care network to prevent them from lapsing further and further into their insanity. And even if Gary is the worst possible case scenario, he is not the only one. And, you know, after all the memes and whatever, there's a bigger conversation to be had about extremely vulnerable service workers doing the type of shit that probably in a racially homogenous, tiny Northern European country with universal health care falls to social workers, psychologists, counselors, cops, nurses, etc. Thanks.
I don't know if I have anything to add to
everything that he mentioned.
I think we covered a lot of it. Actually,
I
appreciate his commentary.
I appreciate the use of loony bin in the way that only Steve can deliver it. But that being said, he's not wrong. We covered it. He's not wrong, though.
I think he includes all of us in the loony bin.
The really galling thing, though, and his voicemail just now made me think of this, but maybe it's something that we've been talking about all along, is he says, you know, this is a guy who had no family or care network and by all accounts just fell through the net and into the depth of depravity. The irony being that for a great many of us, whatever semblance of a care network or chosen family we do have is through people that we see at the movies.
Right.
Or that we know from
or that
cinema.
We know from right. the cinema.
I think that's true.
And one thing, I mean, not to belabor it, but one thing we haven't really talked about is COVID and how that disrupted so many people's routines. And I think many cinephiles are creatures of habit. And it also created, just in general, for all of us, like a spiraling mental health crisis. And I don't think anyone has been untouched by that.
No. I would say that, not to push back, but just maybe recontextualize it. And again, we did talk about it, that the care network, like, we deploy service workers at front of house positions. Like, that's also a care network, because we can also open up that can of worms of, like, how many times have you had someone unsolicitedly cry, you know, come to you and be like, you know, and you're like, okay, you know, and you know, sometimes we joke about it, you know, sometimes they're less harmful, you know, I've witnessed breakups or something. You speak to the person afterwards, you're like, oh, wow. And then you go out with your friends, you're like, and this happened at work. So, you know, I think it's also that we actually do treat service positions as care networks, actually. And again, we talked about this earlier and Caroline brought a point, you know, like having women in that role, like that's not accidental, because that's often what we regulate to do that emotional labor, for others. So that's the only thing I, you know, would recontextualize in that narrative is that, I'm not saying that it stands in place of, you know, proper facilities and proper training. And, you know, I wish those systems were better funded, but I think to recontextualize, it allows us to firmly understand that this is still someone, even at all these intersections of mental illness, right? That was in that position and for various systemic structures made it possible for him to commit violence. Cause like, I think, you know, I think, and to bring specifically the hard racial line and gender line, I think of how many Black women, you know, we see them who are completely at that intersection of mental illness. And they're not perpetrators, you know, they're assaulted all the time, right? So there are things that still need to be considered when we think about that intersection of who falls through the quote unquote gaps and what safety nets they have, be that a little bit of money, be that an apartment, be that someone who can give them money to stay in their apartment, be that someone who's like, you know what, just go to the movies actually, right? That can still make them feel, you know what, I actually have access to this type of violence in ways that other people don't. And by using an example of like a Black woman, I'm not saying that Black women don't commit violence, but rather just trying to, again, contextualize, you know, what accounts of violence become more available to others.
It's a catch-22 too, because the idea, the suspension of disbelief that you continue to extend to people who misbehave in public, who treat the staff of institutions, I'm sorry, I'm trying to find a coaster, who treat the staff of different institutions poorly, you know, versus who is allowed to act up in public and who isn't. Like, who, the minute they let the veil of sanity drop, is escorted from the premises, versus who gets to come back enough times and cause enough problems that they are banned and then they come back again. So you extend that ability to constantly fuck up and come back and fuck up and come back to the people who are most likely to perpetrate that violence too.
And, you know, there was a choice about what day to come to MoMA maybe and stab two people. And who were the two people who were stabbed?
It's, yeah,
it could have been a different day with two different kinds of people working.
Yeah.
And,
which I think is a really good point.
Yeah.
Well, it's not difficult to imagine someone else who didn't exhibit, I imagine, obvious signs of mental illness engaging in similar behaviors and not having their membership revoked because they don't fit
the profile.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are just as many people who are in various, to borrow your turn of phrase, intersections of mental illness or in varying states of crisis, as people are constantly all the time, who don't attack anybody, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's also that larger question that we have to ask of like, well, how do we keep this from becoming the constant state of affairs in a place that should otherwise be, I think, a site of joy and
communion
and redemption and knowledge.
Yeah.
And, you know,
existential crises.
Exactly. And I said this just as you were walking in the door earlier this evening, we were talking about, and I guess this is my through line that I defend as like a good through line into our next topic, but talking about this sense of, you know, the ways that everyone is exhibiting kind of different states of unease, anxiety, fear, irrationality, and how it feels like people have the bends. There is a collective mental bends happening of, we are all rapidly being expected to go back to work, to go back to the movies, to go back to restaurants. And we desire that too. It's an expectation. It's also a wish fulfillment. But the speed at which it's happening, contrasted with the amount of time that people have to readjust, to process their individual and collective traumas, are out of step.
Yeah.
And when you come up for air too quickly from scuba diving, you get these bubbles in your blood that kill you. And I think that what's happening right now is a psychological kind of mass iteration of that.
And a period to mourn as well.
Yeah, well, nobody sat the collective shiva that we all have to sit to deal with this.
And that's, you know, there was a different conversation emerging on Twitter where it was a European, and they were like, oh, you know, Americans don't mourn. And it's like, this is where that specificity matters of like largely white, you know, middle-class Americans, right? Like if that's the culture you're looking at, then sure, we can make that blanket statement. But, you know, especially, you know, Black Southern individuals who like very regionally specific in Louisiana, they make a parade. They mourn for a week. If you think of different and various intersections of Latinx cultures, you know, so I do think that it's who becomes the dominant culture that dictates, no, this is the pace by which we move at, right? And what is in loss through all these other more marginalized forms of collective gathering? Because I firmly believe the resources and connections are out there for us to find ways to heal and respond and grieve and do all of those things. But those are the ones that keep getting chucked out. You don't need to learn about that culture. No. You don't need to learn about that history. No. And I think that's absolutely playing a role in that.
And there's the imposed economic aspect of who mourns too, right? Yeah. Because we have now in the state, we have state mandated family and bereavement leave, but this is a very recent development that was part of, I think, the oh shit, Cuomo resignation grab bag of rapidly legalized things, including weed at the deli, which we've talked about on the show.
Gray area.
Yeah, major gray area. It was one of those consolation prizes that was meted out to people, but I don't think it was thoroughly executed and not very well.
Yeah.
There are people for
anticlimactic.
for whom mourning, grieving, and taking the time that is needed with that process is intrinsically cultural, who don't have the ability to do it because they have to go back to work. And then there are people for whom it's not intrinsically cultural because their expectation is that they are only working or that you process through work. Right?
You're not given the time to mourn.
Yeah.
It's not enough that a certain class of worker in this country is meted out the ability or the privilege rather to work from home. And that should be sufficient.
Yeah.
There is also, I think a years long paid vacation time in order for every person that we are all entitled to, because we should all by rights have the sufficient time to sit with and deal with what we've all been through. One of the ways that people do that here, you know, and we've said it again and again, is like go to the movies.
Yeah.
You have been listening to Episode 5, Part 1, and I want to thank my co-hosts Caroline Gollum, John Claxman, audio engineer C. Spencer Ye, and our very special guest, Dr. Ayana Dozier, who is a bat scholar. So stick around for Part 2, and you can hear all about bat history, gay Batman, bat nips, Prince, some weird record Prince made with Kim Basinger where they have sex. The Screen Slate podcast is brought to you by the German Film Office, and you can stay in touch with them by visiting germanfilm.us. Please sign up for their newsletter, follow them on socials, and also head to Anthology starting Friday to see Ted Fent's film Outside Noise, which was shot in Berlin. And of course, we love Ted here at Screen Slate. He's a former New York City projectionist and translator and just an all-around phenomenal filmmaker. If you want to help support us, you can also visit patreon.com/screenslate. That also helps support the whole operation of ScreenSlate. We do repertory film listings and publish new articles every day. We do screenings and events. And the vast majority of our budget comes from that Patreon. So you can throw $3, $5, or $10 a month and get lots of cool stuff and help us thrive and support New York City film culture. Thanks so much for listening.